welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, ski mountaineer and the first person to summit and ski down all seven summits, Kit DeLaurier talks about her journey through the Arctic Refuge, Northeast Alaska. Hosted by North Face, REI Anchorage, and Single Track Advocates of Anchorage, as part of the North Face Athlete Speaker Series, Kit DeLaurier was recorded speaking at the Anchorage Museum on May 16th.
Good evening, everyone. How you doing? Right on. Thanks so much. My name is Brandon Fries with the Never Stop Exploring Speaker Series. Thank you all for coming out tonight. We're pretty excited. This is our first trip with our series to Alaska, so we're excited for a great turnout, so I really appreciate it. Just want to thank a few of our sponsors, of course, that make this happen and allow us to come up here and give this presentation for you tonight. Of course, we have to thank the North Face first off and all the wonderful gear they make to allow us to explore and never stop exploring and anywhere that you go. Of course, Gore-Tex to keep us dry and keep all the wind off us and comfortable. Primal off for that little bit of warmth, make you that even extreme more comfortable with all the different conditions. I know you guys get some pretty crazy conditions up here and excited for a lot of the snow you guys have had. Also want to thank Outside Magazine for kind of encouraging us to explore a little bit more and reading all the enticing articles that a lot of our athletes are a part of, as well as many other people from around the world. We have a few different national nonprofits we work with: the Access Fund, the American Alpine Club, American Mountain Guide Association, Leave No Trace, and USA Climbing. And right now at the moment, the Access Fund, if you go onto their website, they're looking for some people to kind of help do some conservation for some of the climbing areas around the country. So if you're interested in that, check that out. And also the American Alpine Club, there's always people can go climb the Himalayas and are looking for a grant or a reason to go climb something or explore some part of the world, and they're actually giving a grant out to anyone who applies. So if, someone who wins an application process. So if you're interested in applying, go on to the American Alpine Club website. I also want to thank a few of the groups locally who've come out. And if you guys didn't get a chance to talk to them on the outside there, they'll be here afterwards. You can ask them some questions. But the Eagle River Nature Center, the Nordic Skiing Association of Anchorage, the Mountaineering Club of Anchorage, the Alaska Mountain Rescue Group, Howell, and of course REI. And the last group is the Single Track Advocates. We did a little reception last night to raise money for the group here. And anyone who bought a reserve seat, that's where the money is actually going, is the Single Track Advocates. With REI and all the help that they've done, I really want to thank Mike and his whole team for all the promotion and showing you guys that this presentation is going on tonight. As much as it is a North Face event with Kit, it couldn't be done without REI and the partnership that we have with them. So I want to thank Mike and invite him up here to say a few words and to introduce Kit.
Hi, I'm Mike Morganson, and I do work at REI and have for a long time, and I see a lot of familiar faces out there. I just want to give you guys a little background on Kit DeLaurier. She's one of the people that has big goals and big dreams and has been able to fulfill her dreams. So kind of start off, she's a two-time world free skiing champion in 2004 and 5. After climbing Mount McKinley in 2004, she thought it'd be a good idea to try to climb and ski off all the seven summits. For those of you who don't know, the seven summits are the highest peak on all the continents of the world. And Kit was the first person to climb them and then ski down. After that, she took a little break from competition and has two young children. In 2010, just a couple years ago, she did quite a trek in the Arctic Refuge, skiing and camping and seeing a lot of stuff, and she's going to talk about more of that soon. And a recent inductee into the Intermountain Hall of Fame. And so on behalf of the North Face and Trail Creek Outfitters, I'd like to introduce Kit DeLaurier.
Awesome. Let me see if I can get this out of the way. Here we go. Thanks for having me, everybody, tonight. Mike did just mention about a couple of the several expeditions that I've done up here in Alaska, and inevitably, each one of them starts off with a last-minute shopping trip at REI here in Anchorage. So when I was invited to come up here and speak, I said, oh yeah, you bet. So, all right, I live in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and I am a ski mountaineer. I have also been a competitive free skier in the past. Mostly, I am an adventurer and an explorer, and Alaska is a great place to do that. So I'm really happy to be here with you guys. I rolled in yesterday, and this morning got up and went up Bird Ridge for a little view and something to do. It's very rare. I think this is the only time I've ever come up to Alaska for just a day or a day and a half. So still had to get a little adventure, and I super love this place. I started coming to Alaska when I was 19 on a Knowles trip. And before the Knowles trip started, and I spent 3 months here doing that, I went over to Homer and hitched some rides across Ketchikan Bay with my skis on my pack and explored down there. So Alaska is, I like to say, the place that I come when, where I live, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, starts to feel a little too cosmopolitan, for me at least. So now you know a little bit about myself. I climb and I ski, and sometimes the steeper the better, but it's really, I'm into aesthetics, and skiing is just kind of my way of moving through the world. So when I see a mountain, like when I moved to Jackson Hole, Wyoming from Telluride, Colorado region, and I look up at the Grand Teton, I didn't even really know what it was, and I said, man, that is beautiful. What's that? My husband said, that's the Grand. And I said, but what's that? And he said, that's the Ford Couloir. And I said, I want to ski that. He said, you do? There's really, like, I don't think any woman's ever skied it. It's only been skied a couple times. I said, I really don't care about that. I want to feel what it feels like to be up there, turned around facing down, looking out at the rest of the world. So I'm going to be telling you some stories about my travels around the world, climbing and skiing these seven summits at first. And it might be a little bit of a whirlwind. I'm sure, you know, I'm working on a book of that, and I can write. It's going to be hard to cut it down to 250 pages. So if I'm just going to try and cut seven summits into the next 20 minutes so that I can, or 30 minutes, so I can take you on a quick tour of my experience up in the Brooks Range also, then my objective will be complete tonight. So I will be happy to answer questions at the end. So save those, if you will, for then. One of them, and I'll try and head off some of those questions while I go along, and I'm sure that one of them for some of you in the audience would be, how in the world did she get to do what, become what she is today, and where did she get the skill set for that? And the answer is very slowly and much later in life than any one of you would have anticipated. I was actually born in Albany, New York, and raised largely, at least my early years, in the New England area. This is an image of my grandfather here, who was one of the early pioneers skiing in Stowe, Vermont. And he was actually from the Massachusetts, Connecticut area, but at the time they would go up there on the weekends, and he was part of the New York Amateur Ski Club, I think they called it back then, ski racing. And literally, back in the day when they would spend all day long hiking up the toll road at Stowe for two runs a day. And then now here's an image of my father doing the same thing several years later in the 40s. And my father and my grandfather loved to ski. But they had three kids, really, my parents, my mom and dad, had three kids, of which I'm the middle, quite early in their lives. They had three kids by the time they were in their late 20s. And we didn't live near a ski area, and we really just didn't have the socioeconomic means to get to a ski area and ski. So I grew up basically walking around in the woods in the winter on my cross-country skis. And they were either too tall or too short, because I'm the middle kid. But for me, I really just loved moving around in the woods in the winter, and I think that eventually as I grew my skiing skills, I was introduced to alpine skiing when I was 14 by my dad, who I kind of thank him. I mean, he had so many sacrifices. He gave up skiing until he could afford to take our whole family. But by the time I was 14, we were in that position, and so it was basically my favorite thing to do since the moment I was introduced to it. But I'm going to take you on a quick tour right now of free skiing and what it means to do that kind of thing. It's basically a kind of competition skiing. It's the first time I ever competed skiing in my life. You just heard me say I started alpine skiing when I was 14. I didn't actually enter a ski race until I was 34, and that was on the World Free Skiing Tour. I kind of begged my way onto the tour. I knew the organizer, and he'd seen me ski some lines and jump some 35, 40-foot cliffs and stick it. And he said, man, what in the world? So when I finally decided to compete skiing on the tour, I should say I was probably ready to do it for a little while, but I wanted to wait until I made sure I could be on the podium. So that was when I was 34 in 2004. And yeah, I left that up too long. You can see my age on that. So if you could hear that, that's exactly what he said. Yeah, well, your passport sure will be full. And the next thing I asked him was, well, do you want to come with me? And he said, no. Just make sure you invite me for Everest, because I've always wanted to do that one. So to back up a little bit, he and I actually met on a ski expedition in Siberia in 1999, and he was a videographer, cinematographer for the North Face, and it was the first North Face expedition that I went on. So I was kind of talent, if you will. And so we already knew we had that in common, and we got married the next year. So the beginning of our ski mountaineering together was much, much before the story starts that I'm telling you about tonight. However, that's what we do. That's what we did together. That's what we still do for fun and for vacation, frankly. And so in 2004, it was kind of his turn. I like to play a game, and on this, we do this game where we write down everything we want to do in our lives, and then we share it with each other. And everything we want to do in the next 5 years, and then we share it with each other. And one of the things on his list, one of the things on my list, I should say, was I wanted to ski in New Zealand. And he had already done that 3 times before. He used to be a professional skier, and he was like, all right, he granted me that. And in 2003, we took our vacation, went to New Zealand, and climbed and skied Mount Aspiring, which was a first female ski descent for me at the time. But then the next year, it was kind of his turn. Okay, vacation 2005, where do you want to go? Or 2004, sorry. And he picked Denali. And I'm like, really? I mean, we had just spent a couple of years where we couldn't afford to go anywhere. We were working on our business in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And so now we started to ramp up travel again. And I'm like, you want to go ski Denali or, you know, McKinley? I don't know what you guys all prefer to call it here. But and I said, gosh, you know, we met in Siberia. I thought maybe we could go to Bhutan or something more exotic, you know. We're going to go from New Zealand back to the United States of America. But that was what he wanted to do, and I said, all right, cool. So we went, and it was the month of May, okay? So right about now, we actually summited May 22nd, and it's frankly too cold to precipitate, if you can believe it, and I think you guys probably can, up there, usually, in the month of May. So, but we didn't know that, and May was when we had time. So we went to Denali in May of 2004. I also did a lot of research before I went, and I learned that if you can spend over 20 or 21 days, I think it is, on the mountain, then there's an 80% success rate. And that's just for climbing, and we were skiing, so that's another little factor that I don't have the stats for. But I was like, if you can tell so far from my story, I like to succeed. So I was like, all right, we'll spend 22 days. And now I will tell you to be careful what you ask for, because we ended up there for, we summited on the 22nd day. We ended up there for 25 days. So we went up there for our vacation, you know, climbed, hauled our loads up, and had horrible weather. The jet stream sat up there, the 800 miles of clouds stacked out to the west. We went up and ended up helping out with a rescue up high after a failed summit attempt due to really intense weather, and then came back down. We spent 3 days up there helping our friends from the Jenny Lake Rangers, who were doing a rotation at the 14,000 foot camp, pull off a rescue. Then we went back down to from 17 to 14 and rested for a day and punched it to the top. So it was a super cool experience to be able to put, you know, our objective to the side and help out somebody up there. And in the hidden gift, if you will, we were ready to go for the summit and in one long push. So, you know, we skied off the top at like 7 o'clock at night, and we'd wanted to ski the Messner Couloir or something more exciting than that. But again, it was too cold to precipitate, and that was still blue ice. So we ended up going down, back down the West Buttress route and down the Rescue Gully. You will see a series of things happening here on the screen with these images where, and if I am aware enough to mention them along the way, you'll see that I practiced and learned several techniques through this process of the seven summits, that all of which became very important for me to have in my back pocket on Everest. Like, this was the first time I ever pulled out an ice axe while I was skiing to go down, not just up. All right, so we had Denali in 2004. And now you guys might be asking me, how did you come up with this idea to climb and ski the seven summits? And the answer is, you already heard 2004 was just a pure vacation for us. And 2005, I was competing for my second year on the free skiing tour, and I won both years, actually, the World Women's World Free Skiing Championship title. It's a cumulative point series. But in February of 2005, I was at Snowbird, Utah, and I was competing at the U.S. Free Skiing Nationals in Snowbird. And I met Mr. Dick Bass, who owns the Snowbird ski area and was the first person to climb the seven summits, including Kosciuszko. And I can get into that a little bit more if we have time or anybody's interested. But so including Kosciuszko. So I actually was super sick that night and ended up being the perfect dinner date for Dick Bass, because he just goes on and on and on. He was talking poetry until 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. And I got up to check out of the hotel the next morning, and there was a signed copy of his book, The Seven Summits. And so I read it that spring, and I got to thinking, man, if he's a high-altitude trekker, maybe I could climb and ski those peaks. So it was the spring of 2005, after finishing my second world free skiing title, and I got the idea, and I headed off to Mount Elbrus, Russia, which is the highest point in Europe. Now, it is higher than Mont Blanc, and it is actually technically in Europe. Right there you can see the division line between Europe and Asia. So some people don't realize that Elbrus is the highest in Europe. This is a quick video of what it's like to travel there. We actually climbed the mountain from the north side, which is the first way that the mountain was ever climbed, and it had never been skied from the north. But again, if you can figure my story a little bit so far, I like to do things differently, and that's amazing what a $50 bill can get you. I never got back in that Jeep again. It's like I'm walking the rest of the way to base camp. So we had actually done a little acclimatization hike on the south side of the mountain. Amazingly enough, there's a ski area there on the south side that can bump you up to somewhere around 14,000 feet or something, but it's really the last 5,000 that hurts the most. That usually takes people a couple days, even if they're acclimatized and the weather's just right on the south side. But we wanted to go to the north, so after acclimatizing on the south and in a couple other valleys, we cruised around like you just saw in that Russian Waz Jeep. And we basically put everything on our backs, and right down to the bare feet, walked across the river and up those twin volcanoes. The higher one is the one on the right. It's only higher by a couple hundred feet. But yes, Mount Elbrus is a volcanic mountain. These amazing early morning sunrise shots are common on our summit days. We usually start at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm not at all saying that we're doing alpine tactics all the time on these mountains, but we are kind of making our summit days as long as possible so that we don't have to carry any more than we really have to. We're usually climbing about 6,000 vertical feet on a summit day, which also means we climb into all sorts of snow and all sorts of weather. You can see this beautiful shot right here, moving right into nasty weather on the summit. In Russia, that's a little sign up there. In Russia, every single mountain I've ever climbed, and there have been many actually in Russia, has a plaque on the top for everybody who's died on the mountain. It's quite sobering. And here's a quick video that shows a little bit of what it's like skiing off the top. So we were on the north side. Storms there move from the south to the north. So we actually skied right out of the storm and down into some quite decent weather just ahead of it. 6,000 vertical feet, you come through a lot of different kinds of snow for sure. And then we were trapped for about 4 days by that storm as it chased us out. So that's June of 2005. Now I'm going to take you to the continent of Australia, to Kosciuszko. And you've got it right. We're not missing a one in front of that 7,310 feet. It's not a very sexy number. It is what it is. It's the highest mountain in Australia. All the experts that I spoke with don't believe that Irian Jaya, so therefore Karstens Pyramid, the other debated seventh summit, is a part of the Australian continent. And that answer serves me pretty well because there's no snow on Irian Jaya. anyway, so I went to Australia, and I went in the month of September. It's very hard to find when there's actually snow down there. It's usually in August or September, and it's not even a sure thing every year. And when I started this project, you're hearing these dates of Denali in 2004 and then the rest of them in 2005 and 2006. It's true, I did the rest, all six of them in about a year and a half. So when I was sitting down trying to figure out when to go where, I didn't want to save Cozy Usco's August or September for the next year because I couldn't. I had already signed up for an Everest expedition for the next year. And I certainly didn't want to save it for a whole year after when I had hoped to be completing this project. So I jumped on a plane during a week off from my stonemasonry job, which I do in the summertime, and went to Australia solo. Now, I did that because not even my mom knew that I was going to climb and ski these mountains. I was very, very quiet about this objective. I was fortunate enough to have a philanthropist sponsor, if you will, who I met during my time competing free skiing, who wanted to invest, I guess, in my skiing. So that's largely where the money came from, and eventually the North Face came on as a sponsor for these expeditions. I wasn't in a position to have to go out and sell t-shirts to raise money for these expeditions. And I wanted to keep it simple. I didn't want to talk to the media beforehand. I wanted it to be, it was very much a project for me of traveling around the world and experiencing the world on skis and doing this project. If I felt like, honestly, you'll see some images coming up of a super cold place in Antarctica. If something happened like in Antarctica and I had frostbite or something serious like that, I would have shelved this project for sure. It wasn't about that. It's not about being the super adrenaline junkie. There's definitely a lot of risk management mixed in with what I do. And I didn't want to have to explain myself to the media and to the world if I decided to make a choice like that. So I headed off to Australia all by myself. Basically spent the mornings ski touring. This is not mountaineering, this mountain. Just ski touring up to the top of it and waiting until all the individuals had left for the day that were joking, "We did one of the seven." And then after they left, I'd set up my video camera and do a few shots, and then I'd go down and ride rope toes and ski spring corn slush at the ski area down below called Threadbow. There's a view from the top of Australia, in case anybody wonders. So September 2005, that was that. November 2005, I got myself a seat on this plane, and actually I booked it back in April, so a bit of the advanced planning I'm giving you a glimpse into. This is an enormous plane. It's a Russian Ilyushin cargo plane, and it parks down in Punta Arenas, Chile, in November and December of each year during the Antarctic summer to take climbers and meteorologists and people over to the Patriot Hills base camp on the continent of Antarctica. To get a seat on this plane costs about $25,000, non-guided. Yeah. And then to actually get on the plane and sign all these waivers, you have to come up with $250,000 worth of travel insurance, which sounds like a lot, and it is, but it costs, you know, a few hundred dollars, pales in comparison to the full seat. And you actually don't get a seat for that. You basically sit on a plywood bench with like an army oxygen mask pinned to the wall behind you in case you need it. You can see there's little to no windows on this thing, and it's big enough to fit several snow cats in there, which it actually does. So the reason it's $250,000 in travel insurance is because that's how much fuel it costs to fly this enormous plane, the 5 hours over to the Antarctic continent. So in case they needed to come pick you up for some kind of dire straits, they need to watch out for themselves with the fuel. So Vincent Massif, Antarctica, 16,067 feet. Very, 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 very cold. Coldest place I've ever been. And here's a quick video of what it's like for this plane to land on this anomaly of a blue ice runway that it lands on in Patriot Hills. You dress up in all your Antarctic gear, and you leave Chile, and there's nobody to stamp your passport. It's not actually another country, but it is another continent. So once you land there, it's Patriot Hills Base Camp. They do other work and surveys there. If anybody ever wants to go ski the South Pole, I'm not sure why you would want to do that living here in Anchorage, but if you did, you'd fly to the Patriot Hills Base Camp and then catch another flight like this. We caught a flight like this, not to the South Pole takeoff station, but we caught a flight like this in this Twin Otter, another hour and a half to the base camp for Vincent Massif. And that's located at about almost probably 6,500 feet of elevation. I'm going to show you a quick video here of a little bit of what it's like to be on the continent of Antarctica, because you're governed by a treaty that basically every country that has a piece of the pie that goes into Antarctica and I guess converges on the at the South Pole, if you will, is governed. They all have to operate by this treaty. And among the things in this treaty that we were taught is a very, very, very strict leave no trace policy, right down to where you might be able to empty your pee bottles. If anybody out here is a winter camper, you know it's not really worth going outside to relieve yourself, so you bring a trusty pee bottle. But you gotta realize that your toothpaste is also waste. Super, super, super cold. If I had hundreds of words for snow, I would use many of them there, but one of them would be too firm for the points of my crampons to make a mark on the way up. So that's what it's like skiing back down. So that was a first female ski descent off the summit. A guide there had skied from a high camp, but not from the summit. We were actually stuck at a high camp. To give you an idea of how cold it was there, we were stuck at a high camp for several days with no ability to communicate with base camp. But base camp was 7,000 feet below, and they were measuring temperatures of minus 35 with winds of 70. So probably akin to living in Fairbanks. I had one day to do my laundry in Punta Arenas, Chile, and then I flew to Argentina, to Aconcagua, Argentina, actually to Mendoza. I said goodbye to my husband along the way. He had had enough and needed to get back to work. And I went to Aconcagua as planned because I had been studying the weather, and the South America had the largest amount of snow, the biggest snow season, ski season, if you will, in like 20 years. During their summer, or their winter, our summer. So I couldn't get off of that Antarctic continent fast enough to get over here and start this hopeful ski descent on Aconcagua via the Polish glacier. Aconcagua had never been skied from the summit before. It had, via the Polish glacier, there had been one snowboard descent by a Slovenian. So you're looking right now at an image of the super red south face. Remember, we're in South America here, and so the north face is actually the really gentle side of the mountain. It's not even really gentle. Aconcagua is very, very tall, 22,841 feet above sea level. It's very dry, and the dryness, it's amazing, but the dryness actually makes it very difficult to acclimatize to a high elevation. Aconcagua, I was saying that there's, you know, several lessons, and if I have the awareness during this presentation to remind myself and share them with you along the way. The one I'd love to share about Aconcagua is a big one about egolessness, and it's not all about me. It's not all about you. It's not all about the person that's in the objective. I was climbing for the summit that day with a good friend who is a member of the North Face team and an amazing climber, Damian Venegas, and I watched him not eat, not drink, go super slow. He's probably summited this mountain 20 times. Not via the Polish glacier route, but he had, not 20 times on the Polish glacier route, but he had even summited on the Polish glacier route. And as we got higher and higher on summit day, up to about 21,000 feet, he just fell apart. And it was amazing to watch that, because my brain, I feel like I've got a belt on my head and just keep tightening another notch and another notch and another notch. I went through, you know, all of the aspirin in my first aid kit and all the water I had, but I was watching him going, what in the world? Finally, I said, Damian, I think we need to go down. He agreed. We went down to our high camp at 20,000 feet. Not before I left my skis at my high point. Again, a bit about the commitment along the way. But because there was nothing really to ski below, and it was so much effort to get them up there that I knew I would come back. So to make it easier on myself the second time, I cached my super high mountain gear up there. And I accompanied Damian back to our high camp. He proceeded to throw up several times and then kind of pass out and sleep with some sleep apnea, kind of barely breathing, and then go, and then he wouldn't breathe for a while. And I sat there in the tent watching him and started packing things up. And he wakes up and he looks at me, and I'm kind of nervous because I'm making this judgment call and I don't want him to be upset with me. But he says, what are you doing, Keith? And I said, we're going down, I'm packing up. He's like, okay. So I said, get together your stuff that you want to leave up here. We left up some super high altitude mittens and a couple of things, and we packed up and got the heck out of there. Spent the next 3-4 days resting at base camp, which is 14,000 feet still, so he could get better. And I think he actually had carbon monoxide poisoning from some poor quality fuel we had up there. but it doesn't matter whether it was altitude illness or they all present the same kind of symptoms. There was only one answer, and that was to go down. So we went down, but when we came back up, again, a little bit about the commitment, I came back up with another person that I had recruited around base camp to climb with me, just in case Damien couldn't make it. But in the end, Damien's the one who made it, and that other person was not acclimatized, and we left him partway up the mountain, told him to anchor in, sit tight, we'd be back. So this is the summit. There's no snow, just for like a 30-meter zone around the summit, and then I skied down the, here's the video, skied down the Polish Glacier, which was some of the steepest ski turns I've ever made. And it was the first place, I'm back to that awareness about some of the skill sets. It was the first place I ever skied on belay, dropping into the, right below there, the snow was very, very dangerous. And Damien sat down in the snow. He was not skiing. He sat down in the snow and gave me a belay. And so I took several turns into the couloir on belay because I thought it might rip. Then I had to rappel a little section of about 30 feet in the crux of the couloir there. It just didn't have the snow to ski it. Maybe someday it will. So again, there's an asterisk right there. I'll be talking about another asterisk in a couple minutes. But it was an amazing ski descent. And if anybody wants to ask me like the hardest part, hardest thing I ever skied, I'm going to answer the Lhotse face on Everest that you've seen, that you're going to see coming up in a couple minutes. But I'm going to give those few turns in the upper part of the Polish Glacier there a close second. All right, I'm taking you to Kilimanjaro, Tanzania now. Africa, the highest point in Africa, 19,340 feet. It is very true that there is no snow on the summit any longer, year-round snow on the summit of Kilimanjaro these days. And actually, the snow, the glaciers are like a quarter mile away from the summit these days. This was the only mountain that I had to climb twice. The first time I went, there was no snow on the summit, so I went back the next year, so it's 2005 I'm showing you right now, May, during a super, super rainy season, which was a total bummer for all the friends that went with me because they just kind of got to hike around the mountain in the rain. But it's what it took for me to get up there when there was the seasonal snow that you see here right now, and I skied every bit of it that there was. Everybody wonders how much, and it was 2,500, 3,000 vertical feet of snow, probably about super nice conditions, like it would have been if I had my skis up on top of Bird Ridge today. Really beautiful place, really, really beautiful people. These guys, here they are stopping and erupting into song and dance along the way. Imagine, they had never seen skiing before. They were nervous about how I was going to stop. All right, so here we are, sunrise on the seventh mountain. If you guys have been paying attention, it's time to talk about Everest, highest point in the world, 29,000 feet. It's almost 9,000 meters, so it's very, 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 very tall. Taller than any other mountain in the world. The next tallest one beneath this is K2. And no, I have not climbed K2. I don't really plan on it. Okay, so we climbed Everest from the Nepali side when we went up the Southeast Ridge Route. And it was a time of year when there was nobody else on the mountain. Right now, there's hundreds of people trying to climb for the summit in this traditional climbing season right in the month of May. We went in October. We actually left our home in August, but we went in October. We summited in October. We spent over 7 weeks at base camp or above, which is 17,000 feet of base camp. You basically fly from Kathmandu into a place called Lukla via a little fixed-wing plane, about 8,000 feet of elevation, and then you walk for 10, 11 days to get to base camp. It's super committing. Round trip, we were gone from our home for, 10 weeks. We, looks like here's a quick video that will take you up there. It was a super tight team. There were really just three of us, Jimmy Chin and my husband Rob and myself, that went to ski, and just two other climbers along the way. One of them backed out. The other one was from Canada, kind of on his own. Berg Adventures from Canmore organized the overland travel to get there, but otherwise we were pretty much on our own with our own team of Sherpas that fixed all the fixed lines through the ice fall. Okay. So that is the Lhotse face you're seeing there. Eventually it stormed and everything ripped out and we had to start over again, and it turned into blue ice, and it was very, very, very dangerous. We made an agreement among the three of us that we would climb it first, ski it second, document it third. And here is the, you're looking now from the south summit up the Hillary Step to the summit. We left at about 1 in the morning and summited at about 10 in the morning, which is amazingly good time, especially considering we had to do all of the rope fixing. We were the only team on the mountain and there were no other trails, you know, established or boot packed for us to follow. We did ski off the summit, and then my husband jumped around me to go first down the Hillary Step because he wanted to video that. We ran into a situation where he ran out of oxygen and was basically dangling unconscious from the ropes on the Hillary Step. Then I turned around and looked up at everybody else once I got around the corner enough to see that. And basically saw what was my husband hanging from the Hillary Step, and I looked up at everybody to try and tell them, please go around, and they were all these eyes imploring down at me that they had situations and everybody was running out of oxygen, and I figured that that's probably what had happened to Rob. And so I sat down and anchored myself into the snow, and the only place in the world that I would rather not do that, with my right butt cheek hanging 8,000 vertical feet above the Western Coombe on the Nepal side. But I did that and I took my skis off because, again, it's not about me. And nobody's safety is worth achieving any of these objectives. And so the team started to step over me as I was making the changeover back to my crampons that I got on, but they were so heinously loose that I had to stop later and tighten them up. You can imagine I was absolutely on, you know, 60 plus degree pitch making that changeover. I ran out of oxygen also when I was crossing over to the south summit to get more oxygen bottles to come back and help Rob. And I ran into a situation where I went into the white room for 2 hours. I thought it took me about 20 minutes to get there and get more oxygen, but I was later told it was 2 hours. And I got over there and my hands were like going into a kind of rigor mortis from being deprived of oxygen for so long, and I was beating them open. I can completely understand what it's like for what it was like for those people who have perished up there, because their mental faculties are still working, but they're unable to help themselves. It's a very, very dangerous place. We ended up, all of us, making it down fine, all friends. We never lost any of our fingers or toes. We spent an unexpected night at Camp 4, which is 26,000 feet. It's 8,000 meter peak all on its own. But we spent an unexpected night at Camp 4 with little to no food or water, and then woke up the next morning and strapped our skis, clipped back into our skis, which somebody might ask, and I use Dynafit bindings. And we skied the Lhotse face, which had never been skied before and still hasn't been skied, and that was the most precious experience, really, of the entire trip. Was the three of us felt like we were climbing at, you know, some 513, 514 level out there, free soloing next to each other, just knowing that if anything had happened, there was no way that any one of us could do anything for the other one. It was an amazing experience. 5,000 vertical feet, about 50 degrees of horrible, horrible conditions. And then we skied all the way down out the Western Coombe and partway down the icefall and ran into some situations there. So yeah, we skied off the summit with Everest, and we skied far more than half the mountain, and I'm here to tell about it, but I'm the first one to put the asterisk next to it that it was not a complete ski descent. That really has yet to be done, and again, if you were listening carefully, it was not really about that at all costs. So people are going to wonder, you know, what did you do before this? And I definitely climbed and skied. It was not the beginning of my skiing career, and nor is it the end. I came back from Everest and went several months later, the next springtime, came up here to Alaska, to Prince William Sound. It had been a dream of mine since that trip when I was 19 and got to go to Prince William Sound sea kayaking with some other Knowles students. I wanted to kayak around with my skis and ski things. So that was a really amazing experience. And then I'm going to fast forward into having children. I was actually on Prince William Sound when I found out that we were successful in trying to conceive our first child. Here's some images of Prince William Sound, and that woman in the green right there was actually 5 months pregnant, and I was only 1 month pregnant. She actually happens to be on Everest right now. We've got our kids about the same age. But I put this in there to let people know that, you know, the Seven Summits Project was not the end of what I do and not the defining moment, but it's really just another piece of it. And here's a big piece of it. Here's my oldest. She's 4 on a recent ski trip in the French Alps, actually, this spring. She loves to ski, and she's been skiing since she was 18 months old. Her first word was outside. We live in Jackson, so I said, no, honey, you got to have breakfast first. So this is the younger one, and she is 2 and a half. She had over 40 days on her ski pass this year. She super rocks it. And I put these in here to show, yeah, what something that I was doing for a couple years in my life, of course I'm still doing, I hope to do forever, is be a parent to these two beautiful little girls. But I also put it in because now my expeditions have to have some little bit more meaning for me. I mean, I'm not even going to say more meaning because that's judgmental, but they definitely have to have a kind of meaning where someday I'll be able to explain to my kids why I chose to go where and, frankly, to leave them home. Tia was 9 months old when I left to go up to the Brooks Range. Again, another dream of mine since I was 19 or 20 and heard about how wild and remote it was. And I'm like, man, Alaska is wild and remote in the first place. So if you all are telling me that the Brooks Range is like the wildest and most remote place in Alaska, I've got to go there someday. So these images here are courtesy of Alaska Wilderness League. I very much went there during snow season, which I'm about to share with you. But I put them up on the screen to kind of pique your interest or refresh your memory maybe of what it's like up there. Of course, northeastern Alaska, it's the largest refuge in the National Refuge System, over 19 million acres, and many, many of those are wilderness. I went up there because I wanted to climb and ski, if you're getting the picture yet, the highest mountains in the Brooks Range. They happen to be in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And then inside of that, we were basically dropped off at the Okpilak River and focused our energies there in the Okpilak River drainage of the most glaciated drainage in the Arctic Refuge or in the Brooks Range, which you guys might know has the distinction of being the northernmost major mountain range in the world. Here's a little bit of what it's like planning to get up there. Packing massive duffel bags very carefully. Flying to Coldfoot from Fairbanks and then hopping in with Dirk of Coyote Air, where he flew us a couple hours north to the Okpilak River, which means river of no willows, but now there's several willows there. Might be a little commentary on climate change. And we got dropped off. There were, you know, polar bear tracks about this big, crisscrossing the valley. I was like, what am I doing here? I just left my 9-month-old and my 2-year-old at home. And, you know, I'm all about, like, I have a pretty good grasp of the ski objective and being in control there, but being in control of polar bears, no way. That was actually super frightening. Thankfully, we found one of their dens. I mean, and we saw all these tracks, but they had just left during a major meltout the week before and gone out back out to the north. So our objectives here were to climb and ski the highest mountains. Our first one here was Mount Michelson, because it was frankly right above our heads. You know, about 6,000-7,000 vertical feet in a day. Camp's only 2,000 feet, but.
6,500 vert.
That's what I thought. I think it's actually the fourth now, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. But massive, massive days. This was the only one that we had to do twice. Our first day turned into a recon, and all of us have Himalayan veterans, but we were calling it Arctic scale instead of Himalayan scale. Certainly, it didn't have the elevation of the Himalayas, but massive, massive. It takes a long time to get any place, and the maps are both beautifully and grossly lacking in detail. They leave a lot to be explored up there. So after that successful time, we realized we had one down day on the whole trip, and the silence right after that, which is so nice because then you get to rest. We had terrible weather just one day. We're resting and we're realizing how quiet this place is. And we have all been all around the world. You see, it's mostly women. We had four women skiers on the trip, and then one cinematographer and one photographer that were both male friends of ours. But we all started talking about all the silence. And it wasn't just Hillary and I that are mothers of two little ones that were like remarking on it. It was really, really amazing. It was actually the quietest, deepest, wildest silence of any place that I've ever been. From there, we moved from that camp at the Ocpillic River. We moved deeper, farther south into the mountains, carrying everything behind us on sleds, up the river drainage as it just got narrower and narrower and narrower. Definitely, we saw several doll sheep up on the hillside above us, and here's the remnants of one down the valley below. This is what we looked like, hauling all of our life behind us on sleds. We were calling them our Arctic shopping carts. Camped on any piece of tundra we could find, but we followed these wolf tracks for several days up the valley, and eventually we're able to sniff our way up to the top of Mount Isto, which by some maps is the highest mountain in the Brooks Range. By some other maps, it might be Mount Chamberlain. Regardless, it's, as we know, it may have been the first ski descent. We can't find any other records of people skiing up there. Standing on top of Mount Isto was incredible. When I mentioned this wild, deep silence that we experienced earlier, it was much, much more magnified on this day for whatever reason. Usually we're like, have lots of wind and cold, and you stand on top of a summit for 5 minutes or like a miserable 20. We were up there for an hour and a half. We skied the west aspect, which is beautiful, 7 o'clock at night. You just hang out there for a long time, ski down 10, 11 o'clock at night back to your camp. And I couldn't believe it, like the sensation of how deep and quiet and still and silent. I can feel it right now in my body as if I was still right there. It was remarkable, as remarkable as looking around, just knowing that there was likely no other human being for hundreds of miles around us. We got back to camp, and the next day punched out for one more big summit, and it was actually unnamed. So after we finished that, we moved out across the coastal plain to finish in Kaktovik. It was an ambitious 60 miles, not knowing what the conditions would be like, if there would even be enough snow to get there. It was also a very, very beautiful 60 miles that we pulled off in 5 days. We just walk and walk and walk and walk and walk until, 10 o'clock at night, and set camp and get up and do the same. So grateful for the Robert Thompson in Kaktovik, who gave us the information beforehand that the meltout happens from the mountains to the ocean. So we timed it just right. We were basically there for up in the mountains for the very last day of a solid freeze. And as we moved out to the ocean, we encountered super cold, damp conditions. And yes, it's very, very flat, but it's also very, very beautiful. We saw a number of owls and Arctic fox and moose tracks, right along the willow line there, the northern border of the foothills of the mountains. And I wanted to ski across the coastal plain and add this element of skiing the North Slope, if you will, to our previous objective of climbing the big peaks, to get a feel for what it's like to be up there, because I've heard all sorts of stories, as I'm sure you guys have. And we didn't go up there with any kind of preconceived notions or political agendas, and I still have none at all. Just wanted to see what it felt like. And what it felt like, actually, is the wildest, deepest, most complete silence that I've ever felt. It also felt like the biggest, deepest, most complete wilderness that I've ever been in. And that got me to thinking, you can imagine in 5 days of walking across mostly flat terrain due north that you get a lot of time to think. So what was I thinking up there? What I was actually thinking was about how it's not about the oil. It's about something much bigger than that. To me, it's about a last great place that is completely untouched by man. Almost completely untouched by man, a roadless, trailless area the size of Maine. It was about the experience that I had of this intense, complete silence, where I honestly feel, and I came across this thought as we were skiing north across the coastal plain, that if there was any development out there on the coastal plain of any sort, I would have heard it, if not felt it, from the summit of Mount Isto, which is about as deep into the wilderness as you can get these days. And if that's the case, then what does it mean to look back on something like the 1964 Wilderness Act passed by United States Congress, which says that wilderness, one of the definitions of wilderness at least, is a place where man remains a visitor. So to a place like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that's so, you know, inhospitable to most people, probably not y'all here in the audience, but, and it's difficult to get to, it's expensive, the climate's, you know, harsh, if it's not cold, it's full of mosquitoes. Who's gonna protect a place like this if it's worth protecting? Makes me think a lot about the value of wilderness, and maybe it's enough just to know that places like this still exist. I'm certainly not an advocate for bringing everybody in the world up there and turning it into a big park, but I can honestly stand here and say that I am an advocate now for extending entire wilderness protection to it. I'd like to thank you all for your rapt attention, and I'll take questions whenever you have them. Thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with ski mountaineer Kit DeLaurier, the first person to summit and ski down all seven summits. Hosted by North Face, REI Anchorage, and Single Track Advocates of Anchorage, as part of the North Face Athlete Speaker Series, Kit DeLaurier was recorded speaking at the Anchorage Museum on May 16th. Following Kit's talk on her journey through the Arctic Refuge, Northeast Alaska, she responded to questions from the audience.
Great question. When I'm climbing and the air is getting thinner and it's hard to breathe, how do I adjust when I'm skiing down? With it's not fast skiing. It's faster than walking down for sure. But I was introduced to it really on Denali for the first time. I mean, skiing the Rescue Gully, if you could make five turns without stopping to catch your breath, you literally would pat yourself on the back. It was more norm. Three was more comfortable. And it's really difficult because we're in self-preservation mode when we're on big mountains like that. And the sensation when you're doing something difficult like skiing at altitude is that you're ripping your throat and your lungs apart. It really hurts. And so there are people who would probably push harder and faster, but it's a self-preservation. It's one of these risk management things I was alluding to. So you're like, man, you know, like, what if? And if that's not, if you have to go back up, or what if something happens? You know, you can't be like tent bound and sick and get yourself pneumonia or whatever the ramifications might be from there. So you really do, and you certainly can't fall. So you really do have to be careful and try and push it as hard as you can and as fast as you can, but you're walking this line. So, you know, there's many answers to your question, and the big piece of it is it's not fast. It's not as fast as some people would think. And there's a great deal of suffering involved. And I had somebody describe mountaineering to me as the art of suffering, and the sooner you decide you like it, the better you'll be at it. It's really difficult. A lot of mental focus. You have to keep total focus on the game. Some people ask me, like, is it hard now that you've become a mother? Are you, like, backing off on the objectives and stuff? And the answer is really no. The answer is yes, with, you know, I don't want to be gone from them for 2 months at a time in that aspect. But I still do ski pretty rad things on a regular basis. And I think that I have to more than ever have complete focus in the moment on what I'm doing. Because if I don't have that, then I'm just handing myself a recipe for disaster. And now that's more important than ever now that I'm a mom. So it's kind of three answers to your question there. Does that answer it for you? Cool. Over here?
Tell us about your food. How do you plan your food?
Oh, tell us about your food. I am a Whole Foods advocate. I try and eat, you know, really well. I don't beat myself up about it. I like a Milano cookie for sure. But on big mountain, it all changes on the different mountains. Denali, you know, you stack up on some local stuff. So, you know, you bet we brought a lot of dried salmon and stuff up there. We do a lot of shopping. You hope to do a lot of shopping right before you go on the mountains these days, so you don't have to haul stuff by airplane. But you do bring your own favorite things for high altitude. For instance, Snickers bars available in Asia are not as good as Snickers bars from America. something about the fats in them or something. They're really not very good. They kind of make you sick. So, you know, we had a special stock of American Snickers bars for the summit of Everest. Everest, like, I don't eat Pringles, but a sleeve of Pringles has 940 calories in it. So I ate a whole sleeve of Pringles as soon as I got to Camp 4. sometimes it's all about the calories and how many calories you can shove in. But usually it's, you know, dried foods. My favorite breakfast is instant mashed potatoes with a little bit of butter and salt and pepper in them, maybe a little garlic powder. I'm a kind of a savory person. I've eaten enough oatmeal in my life. And we, you know, a lot of just like cheese and salami, and I'm sponsored by Goo. I actually really do like the Goo products. Sometimes they make you choke when you've been really putting out some huge, hard, long days, but they super, super work. On a mountain like Everest, another piece of it is staying healthy. That's the biggest thing. I really felt like I had the mental control and the skill set to do it if the weather would offer the mountain to us, but I just needed to stay healthy. And so for that, I did some research. I worked with a local naturopath in Jackson, where I live, and she found out that there's studies that show that if you take, you know, 6, 8, 10,000 even milligrams of vitamin C a day can help acclimatize. So I did that. There's a lot of different little tricks of the trade, but you eat often in small amounts and before you're hungry, and then sometimes you just know that you can go a long time without eating anything at all. So we trained for not eating. Sometimes in the Tetons, we'd go for days right before, like Everest, we'd go for days of, you know, big 13-16 hour day with, you know, a liter of water and three goos or something like that. Right up here, I see a question. Right.
Could you describe that?
The ice axe for skiing or climbing?
Skiing.
For skiing. Well, again, I pretty much know I'm not going to fall. That's my objective. So, but in case I need it, when I start off on the summit of a mountain where I think I might need it, and I'm done climbing up with it in my hand, I'll go ahead and put it in my harness. You know, we're wearing harnesses usually on these mountains. If you're ski mountaineering, you're wearing a harness. So I put the ice axe in the harness, in a gear loop, either on my backpack waist strap or on my harness, so it's right there. And if I'm in a situation where I need it, I just take one of my ski poles and I stuff it. I kind of arch my back a little bit and create a little gap, and I stuff that ski pole handle first down that space in my back, between my back and my backpack, kind of off at an angle like that. And then I just grab the ice axe out and have it in my uphill hand. For instance, on Everest, skiing the Lhotse face, that was so incredibly scary. And it got really, really steep and really, really icy with like white ball bearing chunks, you know, larger than marbles of ice. It was frightening. I skied with my ice axe there, and I actually got to a place where I had my ice axe in my uphill hand. This was the most extreme ever. And I would say to myself out loud, like your life depends upon it, turn. And I'd take my downhill hand and use my pole to make a pole plant, which is, you know, more about just your timing and everything, and make my turn, and I'd stop. And I'd take the ice axe to my uphill hand and put my pole there, make my plan, like your life depends upon it, plant the pole, turn. Out loud, and then I would do it. So there's kind of a full range of, sometimes you just have your ice axe out to wait for somebody and you're like in a safety position in case something happens, and then sometimes you're actually trying to ski with it. I have time for one more question, then I'll be signing posters or whatever. So if you want a poster and you want to come ask a question or something, this young woman's got her hand up. Well, she's asking, how did I decide to do it again after the first time when it hurt? And some of us kind of like some degree of what other people would consider suffering, because it actually helps you control your mind. And when you put yourself in a position where you're forced to gather mental control, you're not making a shopping list. You know, the world is pretty simplified, if you will, and you're forced to go to a place in your mind where your consequences are very dire, and so you must stay there and stay really simplified. You must decide to, you know, smile in the face of adversity, and you learn to enjoy that kind of challenge of, you know, finding the beauty in the moment, because it's all your own interpretation of what suffering is. I don't actually think it's suffering. That's what I said. The sooner you decide you like it, the better you'll be at it. So thanks everybody for coming, and please do come ask me any more questions later on.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with ski mountaineer Kit DeLaurier, the first person to summit and ski down all seven summits. As part of the North Face Athlete Speaker Series hosted by REI Anchorage, Single Track Advocates of Anchorage, and North Face, Kit spoke on her journey through the Arctic Refuge, Northeast Alaska, and responded to questions from the audience at the Anchorage Museum on May 16, 2012. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.